Welcome to the Tuesday, July 9, 2019 session for Tangerine SDR. My name is Dave, KV0S, and this week I've been working on the HP SDR programmer and modifying some of the structure so that I can make it easily modified to other protocols. Done that, and I also posted the Friedrichshafen videos, which several have some relevant topics to some of the topics we talk about here. So you'll find them in the video section of the website, so enjoy. And that's about it for me. The only other thing I'll tell you is I've been sick for a couple weeks, and then I gave the bronchitis to my wife, so I'll probably jump out of here a little early to go take care of her. So next on the list is Mike AAK recording, and Mike, do you have any comments? No comments at this time. And so Nathan, next is Nathan W2NAF. Go ahead, Nathan.
Hi everyone. Not too many comments right now. I guess one thing is I have put together a schedule. A rotating schedule of different scientists, ham radio, will be joining in the meeting. So that'll help to spread things out a bit. So I think Phil Erickson is supposed to join in next week. So back to the group.
Fine business. And next on the list is Tom N5E. Go ahead, Tom.
Oh, good evening, Dave. The list. First of all, I got a digital RF reader working under GNU Radio. And I have to give a lot of thanks to Phil and to Ryan for fixing. There was a module. Ryan updated it and pushed out version 2.6 to install that. So I'm successfully reading the HDMI digital files. Nathaniel put up his field day files, was able to yank a subset easily. So those work. Second, it took about a minute to put together a flow graph to transcode the digital RF into WAV file format. So I put together a WAV file version for Scotty, and then ran into the difficulty of no place to put two of my cloud providers. Basically can't upload files over 50 megabits to the cloud. And so we have to figure out if we're going to transfer files to cloud, how to, I think having paid cloud subscriber address that. And then let's see, after our discussion revised the clock module spec, and Rick Hambly asked me Word version of that. So I think Rick has made some additional edits with the clock. Next, put together a prototype for the ICD interface control document. Never written one. And so I'm not really sure what needs to be. I asked Scott, and I see Scotty sent me to look at those after. Finally, there was a discussion endurance of disks, Rust, solid-state disks. The thing I found is that the video surveillance disks, and one manufacturer calls those purple, and another one has it. But those disks are oriented more continuous write act than typical disks. Application, they're basically the time. And so that may be one thing to look at. The cost of those was if compared to normal disks as to endurance related issues. So that was the week here. Go ahead.
Well, fine business. And next on the list, we have Scotty, WA2DFI. And Scotty, I jumped in here, but I'm going to have to leave it sometime before the end because my wife is sick and I need to help her, but I wanted to come in and check in. So go ahead, Scotty.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave. And thanks for taking up the duty again. I seem to have trouble getting here on time. I managed to make it about 2 minutes after the time started, so I missed Nathaniel's comments. Tom, I did send you an email from work and then hopped in the car and drove home. So fortunately the traffic was light and I got here in the nick of time. So yeah, I did have some comments there on the format looks good. Had some comments on the name and some things. And I actually this week, my phenomenal accomplishment was basically making a list of all the documents I think that we need. And I see you put in a change block in the document, which lists the author, which is one of the things I was going to ask, because we have lots of documents and it's going to get confusing as to who wrote what. So it'll be good to have someone's, not necessarily the person who wrote everything, but the primary contact, like Nathaniel would say, the PI, the owner of the document, so to speak, to address changes to and comments. So I thought that was pretty good you added that in. And not a lot happened this week. Hopefully I'm going to get my head above water here this week, because I know, Tom, I owe you some mechanical diagrams of the DE and the way things plug together. And I'm not sure if that belongs in an ICD for the data engine or exactly where that belongs. But if the format that you've got looks good, then, you know, we can start building those documents for the other, for the RF module and for the data engine. And I guess that's about it. So I'll turn it back over to you, Dave. And whenever you have to leave, just let me know.
Fine business. And next on the list, we have Bill, AB4EJ. Go ahead, Bill. I know you are traveling. He said he's on in the car and may be in and out. He's driving from one place to another.
Yeah, I saw him drop out there, but then he came back. So hopefully he can hear anyway.
Scotty, I did want to tell you, I said this before you came in, but I uploaded the Friedrichshafen talks to, or didn't upload them. I put links to the Friedrichshafen talks on both the Tangerine and the OpenHBSDR websites. There are two that are relevant to this group that I can think of. One is a fellow that was using KiwiSDR for time difference of arrival calculations on signal, and that was very interesting. And he could look at radio propagation effects on, since he already knows where the real site of radios are, it allowed them to actually look at propagation difference. The other talk was related to the fellows at SatNOGS and their use of traveling telemetry and in monitoring space satellites, the things that they were working recently. And they have a lot of pending projects that were quite interesting. So I think several of the people in this group might be interested in those talks.
Yeah, and we've actually talked a little bit to the SatNOGS guys, Tapper has, about maybe making some kits for them, because while they're interested in the design and building of the prototypes, they don't really want to do production, I don't think. So we were talking to them about maybe doing some production, helping them with that. But so far, we haven't really got anything definitive yet. So thanks for those links, though. I'll go check them out. They sound interesting. The guy doing the time difference, is he using a GPSDO to get his base time to calculate the differences? Or how's he doing that? Did you watch it?
The KiwiSDR has a GPS on each receiver board. So you have, it's basically a fairly nice receiver board and a GPS linked to it. But it's still, you know, the whole board set is $300 altogether, so they're not high-end stuff, but it was pretty amazing what they could do with the board set, and they're in Andras's network, so you can set up a transmitter signal and then measure distances from each of the receivers and look at how that varies, knowing where the boards really are.
Okay, so is that data from the receivers, is that networked back to some central place?
Yes, back to SDR.U. And they were able to, Andras has added pieces in his software to allow you to monitor 3 and 4 radios at the same time and collect the data and then do some data now.
Oh, wow, that sounds really interesting. And what are they, like half-hour talks?
Yeah, something like that. They might be even a little longer than that. But they're basically on YouTube is where the talks are stored, and I just put links to them. And it has a title of a talk and the link and that kind of information as well.
Okay, very good. I really want to look at that. So are you back with us yet, Bill?
So, Scotty, the talk that I was talking about is the Christopher Mayer. And he is an employee at CERN and was looking at what he could do with this source network in terms of atmospheric propagation detection.
Okay, I see it now. DL1CH, and he used GNU radio?
He did for some of the processing, but then he also gives some examples of the other stuff. Several of these talks are quite good, and there is this SDR makerspace where they're trying to work on tool chains for open source satellite communications. I thought that was a really interesting one for some of the things. They did have Joe Taylor pop in, but he was just sort of saying hi to everybody and then went on to a different session. So there's several, this makerspace where they're exploiting the SDR technology communications. That was a good talk too. So there were several that were quite useful. The Flex Radio one was remarkably similar to the Dayton talk.
Oh, okay. And I see Pieros is, he's a SatNOX guy, the guy talking about SDR for space.
Yes.
Yeah, I think there's a fair amount of commonality in our networking that we might look at for us, between us and them.
Yes, and the other really interesting one was the last one, which was a professor from Spain, and he had used an SDR to decode, essentially making a GPS SDR receiver.
Wow, talk about rolling your own, huh?
Yeah, it was interesting. But it is, notice he's not a ham, he's an academic, so, but it was an interesting way of going about it.
Yeah, sooner or later, we're going to have to go over there and visit them in person.
Yeah, Dave Whitten has gone over there, and of course, Phil and Warren and John Melton give talks, but they tend to give them generally every 2 years, and this is the off year for the OpenHP SDR guys.
Yeah, okay. And, oh, and by the way, I wanted to mention, maybe someone mentioned it already. Did you see the latest QEX has an article on Themis, the GPSDO that that John has built, AB6JC, I think is his call?
Yeah, I remember talking to him a lot about how he was designing it, and he would get into details that were a bit beyond me when he was doing it, but it took him several years to get that built. And then because of the way he went about it, there wasn't a huge amount of interest when he got the boards finished. So I don't know if he's produced very many.
It looks like it's mostly on the Atlas bus. It's 10 megahertz and one pulse per second and, you know, things like our clock module would produce. But the algorithm is implemented in a TMS320, a DSP processor.
Yes, I think that's right.
Have you seen that article, Tom?
I just got my QX today, and I noticed it by the chance.
Yeah, I kind of skimmed through it, but it's very, it seems like there's not even a block diagram there. So it looked like very technical, which is going to take a sitting down and seriously applying some time to reading it, which I want to do.
Yeah, it appeared the article, just look at the diagram, spent a loop control, you know, PID type loop control. I haven't had a chance to get it, so.
Yeah, he uses the LEA, the 6 model. What's that, M6?
Okay, yeah, I've not looked through all the different versions. I've only M8, F, so I'm the predecessor functionality, the black version.
Yeah, I think it was an LEA M6T was what he was using, if I got it right. And I saw Bill's transmit light flash there. Are you with us, Bill?
Yeah, sorry. I had a lot of problems. First, I went into an area of no cell coverage. Then I found what I think might be a bug in TeamSpeak server app of the iPhone. When used with Bluetooth, if you get a text message, I'm getting several text messages about another meeting, and it knocks the interface into a dead thing where the only way to get it back is to disconnect and reconnect. And then again, another text message knocked off again. So I just decided not to kill myself by trying to mess with that while driving on a twisty, curvy road. But I'm back and I'm in my office.
Yeah, don't kill yourself on the highway.
Anyway, are you waiting for a report from me on my activities?
Yeah, please go ahead.
You might have seen what I published a thing that went out on the mailing thing about some of the work I've been doing with simulating the tangerine using. Now I've got the, and I can keep up with the speed with the possible exception of a few buffers here and there, and going back and forth with on this. I'm going to try a little bit, a slightly different tack. I'm you know, we talked about, you know, solid state drive, but a solid state drive that's 4 terabytes is going to be extremely expensive. And I figured this, I can 2 commodity type hard drives and just write out 2 sessions. It will multi-thread if you have 2 complete different sessions and write 4 channels to one hard drive and 4 channels to the other. And I got another hard drive at Best Buy, portable one. I'm going to test that tomorrow. Other than that, I think you probably have most of my report of my recent activities on what I sent out by email.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Tom.
I was going to say, Bill, one thing I noticed, Phil had some comments about the of the drives, and I was mentioning availability, inexpensive video surveillance drives, which have a much higher level of endurance for writes.
You'll tell me a brand and model. Is that how I would search for this? Video surveillance drives or something? Another drive, that the drives that go into DVRs tend to have a very high duty cycle. I'm sure that we can find some drives that will be the right, what would we say, compromise between cost and capability and reliability.
Yeah, one of them I looked at was called a Western. They color code their drive names. Red is network attached storage, and they've got some others. But the purple drives are their video surveillance ones. They're not any more expensive than consumer models, but they have a much higher endurance level. There's another name for the other manufacturer, and it was in an email I sent a couple months ago. But I think just the generic term of video surveillance or recording will lead you to those type drives. My recollection is 2 antennas and 8 channels. It was at like percent specific. 2 of those might just kind of squeak or asking it.
Well, that's good input, Tom. I will definitely.
So, Bill, what did you attribute the N2's performance increase to? Area, does it do better than the XU4? Can you identify that or not?
Well, just going by impression, it looks like the processors are faster. And from what I have read in the detail, I haven't tried to actually sit down and run benchmarks, computer benchmarks, but I understand that the memory access is faster. So with the Odroid, I found that the bottleneck on writing out digital RF data was the speed of the CPU. I was maxing out the CPU and not getting all of the data written. With the N2, the bottleneck is no longer in the CPU. The bottleneck is now in the drives, the speed of writing to the drives. And we do have a solution for that, which I'm pretty sure will work, splitting the writing out to 2 different drives. I'm going to try that tomorrow and verify that does work. But Phil and I discussed this, and we have a pretty good feeling about that should do it, and that also helps bring down the cost, that you don't have one device that's phenomenally expensive. Now, SSD drives also wear out, so we're hoping if these drives that Tom was just talking about, drives that are optimized for ultra-long lifetime and high duty cycle and long, you know, large amounts of writes, that might be the best way to go. If put 2 of them to work and split the load. So we're going to test that.
So basically poor man's RAID, in other words.
Yeah, I guess you would call it that. Although with RAID, you're writing this thing out to multiple devices. So if you lose one of them, you haven't lost any. But with this, I don't think it's going to cause a catastrophe if one drive, hard drive, just dies. You just won't get those channels until you get a replacement. But this actually allows us to split the load so the drive is not being pushed to the maximum writes.
Well, I guess it depends on what type of RAID, because not all of them are meant for redundancy. Some of them are meant for throughput. So you're doing the throughput kind, which basically takes multiple drives and spreads what you want to write over them without redundancy. And but that's usually reserved for really high-end systems, and they have hardware to do it and all that. But this sounds like and sort of like you've got multiple processors and you're manually assigning threads to each one, right?
Yeah, the system is pretty smart about doing that. You see, I just start one and then start the other, and they run independently, and you can watch the trend. Even when you're just running a single one, you watch the CPU load from one processor to the other as the processor manages the thermal situation. I mean, they don't like to take a single thread and run it full bore and let the other one sit idle. You will watch that they move the load around. I suppose that's to spread out the thermal load across the chip.
Wow. Okay. So do you think you can gain an advantage by adding some thermal management to the board, like liquid cooling or more air or bigger heatsink or anything?
Well, the N2 already has I don't know how close you've looked at the N2, but it is the way the CPU is mounted on the bottom side of the board, and the entire bottom side of the board is covered with a gigantic heatsink. And I haven't tried to see how hot I can get it, at least not yet. But you could certainly put active cooling on it.
Yeah, I have an N2, so I've seen that how that works. But I don't really have anything like you do that really taxes the CPU. So my heatsink never gets beyond just barely lukewarm, just with surfing around and, I'm not doing anything stressful at all.
Well, I believe there's probably a way I can do temperature. And what I'll do is once I get my different drives running, I may run it for an hour or two and then have another task running to output the CPU temperature from time to time and just see what it does.
Isn't there an app you can run that graphs the temperature, or does that take up too much CPU time to do that?
Oh, something like that certainly wouldn't take up too much CPU time on a processor like this. This is pretty much equivalent to a modern typical desktop.
Yeah, I'm thinking of something like SpeedFan for Windows, but they got to have an equivalent for Linux.
Yeah, I haven't really looked into it, but I'm kind of surprised if they didn't. I mean, most things when I've gone looking for it have been available for Linux. The first thing I ran into this week was I thought, this is such a nice system, I could use it for other things, and I went and looked for a printer driver for my brother laser printer. And there is firmly no ARM driver for that printer, so you just can't use it with that computer, at least as far as what I've been able to determine so far. But anyway, kind of getting off topic there. Sorry.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it's interesting to know. It's like my only B-size printer I have. Speaking of off topic, is a LaserJet 4V, ancient thing, probably 30 years old. And I cannot find a Windows 10 driver for it. So I'm really, Windows XP you can, but that's the last driver I've seen. So now I'm trying to find a B-size printer that I can afford.
Well, the N2 is so powerful that I wouldn't be surprised if you dug around a little bit, you might be able to find an emulator that would allow you to run Windows XP in a virtual machine on this, because it certainly has the power to do it. Anyway, we probably should get back to the topic. I've kind of given my report, and I will certainly apprise the team of what I find out in the next couple of days. I'll be doing a lot more stuff. And also, I think it's also been decided pretty much that we are going to have the next HAMSci conference not at UA, because Nathaniel needs to keep away from doing it during... he wants to do it during his spring break, and that's exactly when we can't do it. So we're going to look at maybe see what we can do about the following thing works out and a little better on that.
How about University of Arizona or ASU?
There's some possibility of that. Right now I'm talking to Dr. Elizabeth McDonald, who is the person in charge of the Aurorasaurus Citizen Science Project, and we're talking about possibly doing a joint meeting with her and with Aurorasaurus. So that's what we're working on right now.
Okay, so what's Aurorasaurus? I haven't heard of that before.
Aurorasaurus is an optical people who look at the aurora. So it's another big science project that's dealing with space science, but they're more optical and higher latitude, and HAMSci is more radio and middle latitude. But we're looking at ways that we might be able to join some of the citizen science efforts together.
Okay, that sounds interesting. And you know of the SARA conference that's at Green Bank in August, right?
Yeah, I think we were talking about that a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, I don't know if they leave their facility open to to events like that, but that might be an interesting time. Of course, I'm not sure West Virginia in February is a good time.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'll have to work on this a bit more.
Okay, very good. And you know, the Sarah people, are they, they're in Colorado Springs, I think. Are they affiliated with the university or not?
I'm not sure if they are.
You know, I talked to him at Hamvention, but I didn't really ask him that question. So that would be, I don't know, interesting maybe. Or maybe, how about your new place?
That is certainly a possibility. Once I get there, it'll be a little easier to work out some of these things. So I'm actually going to move to Scranton August 5th, and then I'll be getting into the whole learning how everything works over there. So there's a bit of a transition time right now.
Oh, yeah, you're going to have fun.
Oh, yes, I'm already having fun.
Yeah, moving your whole household with what is he now? He's is he a year now, right?
No, just 5 months. So he'll be about 6 months when we move. So I think the big thing right now is just, yeah, getting us over there. I have to be ready to teach classes and learning the whole new system and a whole new way of doing things. So, yeah, I'm continuing to work on trying to get things like the HAMSci workshop and this other stuff moving smoothly along, too. I'm also still working on writing up a summary of the last HAMSci workshop. So hopefully I can get it all.
Oh, okay. Very good. Well, speaking of workshops and things, DCC is in Detroit, which should be not too far from, actually a little closer to your new place. It's going to be in September. And I forget the exact, maybe Tom knows the exact date. It's like the 19th and the 20th, 21st, and 22nd, I think. You remember if that's right, Tom?
I'll have to look it up. They just issued the call for papers, so do you want to start?
Yeah, that means I usually start after the final call is over, the deadline's over.
Yeah, the deadline's about a month away. I didn't have any plans to write anything. I'm doing the 7 weeks after. Hang on here, scroll.
Yeah, you're doing the GNU Radio at MUD, right, in Dallas?
Yeah, that's been frightfully busy. I've got the 3-hour seminar together, and we're going to do a demo of a microwave station or at this part of the seminar. And I took my code up to a friend's house on the way, tested it, and he said, the DCC is Friday the 20th of September, Saturday and Sunday 22nd.
Okay, so immediately following, literally tail ending on the GNU Radio Conference, which I think is the 16th through the 20th. Which, by the way, we're trying to avoid this happening again. Next year in 2020, the plan is to have it in Charlotte and have the conferences back-to-back, but the other way around. So GNU Radio will be immediately following DCC. So DCC will be Friday, Saturday, Sunday. GNU Radio will be Monday through Friday, and they'll tail end. And maybe if we're really lucky, they'll be in the same hotel.
Oh, that would be nice. Didn't do that once, like 5 years ago.
Yeah, in Atlanta in 2015, I want to say, maybe. And it was really awesome. I went to both. It was really great.
Yeah, I've never been to the GNU Radio. That would be something forward to. It was interesting. It has some operating modes when you try to duplex. And so the week was trying to sort out its due. Not really to this.
Okay, so I made up a tentative list of what I think are the documents we need. Forward that to the list, maybe, and let people comment on it and shred it and tear it apart and say it's great, it's bad, whatever?
Yeah. I'd identified 4 module types, the magnetometer, the GPS module, and the data engine. And then there would probably be, various documents. What's your list?
Yeah, exactly. And I'm not sure if I included the magnetometer. Maybe I did because I read it after talking to you, and it's a good one to have because we're going to need that for the PSWS. But to my mind, the support for the magnetometer is what we're going to need because it's going to be on a standard interface, but we're going to have to integrate the data somehow into, we're going to have a packet format or something, or a data type or metadata indicating what it is.
Yeah, there's a couple of pieces there. The magnetometer has to plug onto the signal conditioning, which gives remote power, remote interface, so it could, so little tiny might be sort of a spec.
Yeah, and I'm thinking that the signal conditioning board that goes on to the data engine is going to be part of the magnetometer assembly. So you'll have the remote assembly that will talk over the wire, and then you'll have the receiver, basically, that receives the signals on the wire, and, you know, provides ESD and level translation, provides like a PMOD interface or SPI or something.
Yeah, I can see that. So a host adapter, a client magnetometer too.
Yeah, and you could even make the magnetometer and the client adapter board, I guess, would be the far end. That could be all on one board because it would always talk like that. But then the incoming end would have to have some kind of interface on it it would be a dumb board. It'd be just, buffers and ESD protection. It wouldn't have to do any protocol conversion.
Right. Yeah. So I see two small boards of that. So I'll be interested in at your link. It kind of aligns with.
Yeah, and I'm kind of trying to avoid going overboard with the documentation list, but I think there's really a place for a lot of these a fair number of simple documents to me is much more desirable than a super complex set that nobody can figure out how to update.
Yeah, I tried the ICD 3 pages. Most of that is.
Yeah, so the ICD then should really focus on the connectors and what kind of interfaces there are. And when I did have another comment that I didn't write about in my email, I don't really think that on the clock board we should have any SMA connectors. I think everything should go through the M2. Do you think that's possible?
I don't know. That's a possibility. The reason Rick, a few others have a desire to use clock for things.
And I'm thinking that John Ackerman had the best idea I've heard so far is a little cheap carrier card that plugs on that has all the connectors on it that you plug the clock module into.
Okay, I see what you're saying. Yeah, that could.
Just trying to keep the cost of the clock module down by not adding a bunch of connectors. And then you get into the nastiness of how do I run the cables off it and all that. And really the one that's going to be the most difficult probably is the antenna, don't you think?
Well, yeah, that's got to be L-band. It's got to be laid out to because it's got GPS receive signals, and it's also got a source power GPS antenna, so a little tricky.
Yeah, and the M.2 connector is designed to handle PCI Express at 5 gigabits, so 5 gigahertz. So I think that as far as the connector goes, I think we should be okay with the speeds of the signals that we're putting across it. I'm not sure what kind of impedance bump you're going to get when you start putting 1.5 gigahertz signals across it, though. I don't, we'll have to see.
Yeah, I can see where the M.2 is for digital signals. It's fairly impedance has got reasonably return loss. I am concerned may not be specified in terms of unwanted ingress or.
And I'm not sure I understand what that means.
Well, for example, the signals coming down from the antenna are fairly weak. They're not really digital signals. They're kind of at the noise level. And so if there's crosstalk, that signal would obscure the desirous receiver.
Okay, so we can mitigate some of that by putting some guard band grounds around that pin. You know, use up a few extra pins to protect it.
Yeah, that certainly will help. We just have to also make the traces exposed, covering them, the internal plane or, something those lines, a crosstalk.
Yeah, what do they call it, strip line or what's the other one? There's one that's on the surface with protection on either side, and then there's one that has grounds on the top and bottom with controlled impedance.
Yeah, so I'm not sure, those connectors have been raised and those parameters are not sure. So, but if we can make all of that work, then we could get rid of two SMA connectors, that would be useful.
Yeah, and in my email, I said that, and maybe you can find different ones. I can't find any other key. There's 12 different keys defined by the M.2 standard. I can only find 4 of them that are made, A, B, E, and M. Even though there's a whole bunch of other ones that are defined, I can't seem to find anybody that has connectors that I can actually buy. Even if you go to like AMP, their definition of their connector, it only defines those 4 keys, not the others.
Yeah. In thinking about that, there's 2 used common in computers. There's what M for, I forget which they are, B and an M. One is used a lot for Wi-Fi modules and one is used for music.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think it's B and M, but then there are some of them that have both notches out so they can plug into either type of connector.
Yeah, it may not be a problem mixing things up, computer stuff. Assume folks wouldn't accidentally those in. I would think if we're going to key the RF module one way, we'd want to key the clock module the other way.
Yeah, and I think that's a good idea because while they're, if they want to plug a solid-state drive into the RF module port, they get what they deserve. but I could see you accidentally plugging the clock module into an RF port or vice versa. That would be easy to.
Yeah, we'll probably have to be careful to follow power and ground such that if somebody interchanged, at least they diverse power and ground or something.
Yeah, and I think that's going to be hard because from the few that I've looked at, I couldn't detect any pattern in.
Okay, well, if we can get an example to lay out, able to, by correctly assigning ins, prevent our two modules from being each other.
Yeah, I know one of the things that I did, which seems maybe too brutal, but when we used to have the 44-pin exerciser connectors, where you could actually, if you didn't have it in the chassis, you could actually plug the board in 180 degrees out because there was no key. So what I ended up doing is I took the two pins that were the power and ground that were on the opposite side, and I made them both ground. So what would happen is if you plug the board in backwards, you basically shorted the power supply out, which my assumption was that you have a current limited supply, and that would basically stop the entire machine from coming up and burning things out.
Okay, well, that'll be one of those things on the list.
Yeah, and I presume that pin list that you had in your initial ICD, that was just so far the pins that you've come up with, right?
Yeah, I just numbered them starting at one. The number, any meaning? I was just trying to count all of the signals.
Yeah, because they count all the connectors are numbered 1 through 75, and then some of them are missing depending on what key you got.
Yeah, that was just a prototype. It's not a real spec. I had to make sure that we had all the right the module profiles and where's the connect, where's the screw that screws it down, how much vertical height pins. I was just trying to make sure it got all the important stuff rather than trying to make that an actual was useful.
So then how would we do it when we when you get, I can see how when you got the RF module, you can have a certain size outlined, and we might have a couple of different ones that, like the M.2 has some smaller ones in case you want to make a smaller one, or a maximum outline, which is the maximum that the data engine will accept, and, put the screw hole in the right place for the different modules. But then when you get to the data engine, and we're talking about different data engines, like I was envisioning a Max 10 for an entry level, and then a Cyclone 5 for an upscale model. I would try to not move any connectors around, but it may be that the board wouldn't necessarily have to be the same size if it has a significantly different part on it. Like, for instance, if we ever made an SOC version, it would have to have extra parts on it to do to provide the support for the Linux. So it might end up having to be a bigger board. So I guess we could add a section to the ICD for, data engine type 1, type 2, type 3, when and if we ever get there. But is that the proper way to do it?
Well, that's a good question. For the plug-on modules like the clock module, I would think we would want to say we have variants of clock module. They should fit with out, use the, and then there might be two variants that use different boards or be two variants that use the same. But then the data engine board would be able to accommodate either of those types. Now, if you want to have different data engine boards, you might move the M.2 connectors around, but you would have to maintain the layout such that a clock module that plugged onto one kind of data engine would be still.
Right. So the keep out area and the dotted line around the module would have to be the same from the clock spec so that the data engine could accept any of them. Yeah, that was kind of intent. Okay. But data engine 1 and data engine 2 might have different locations for that module.
Well, sure they could. In fact, they probably will, but they still have to have the same. Although, the keep out area on one could be rotated degrees compared to another. Something those lines. That's why I was looking for a sketch.
Yeah, I made a sketch a couple of weeks ago, and I've been derelict in sending it out because, it's always like, oh, it's not quite done. I want to tweak on it. It's like, no, I should just put it out and let people comment on it and get a better design that way.
Yeah, my experience has been I can the heck out of it, and then when I send it, I'll find that I missed, have to start over.
Yeah, really, that's for sure. So anyway, I'll slap it into a document. I drew it up in, of all things, in OrCAD. So I looked around for CAD programs to use and discovered that, to my dismay, they all had a higher learning curve than the amount of time I was willing to put in to get to the drawing stage. So I just did it with OrCAD, and so it'd be relatively simple, but it gives you shows you the stack up and the orientation of the RF modules, the clock module, the how we would marry it to a Raspberry Pi type board or an M2, and how we could fit in the other connectors that would go to either plug-on boards or cables.
Okay, yeah, that's really the key drawing, because from that drawing, then you have the outline of and the connector type for doing the ICD module and the adapter widget for the magnetometer. All of those things, you know, kind of derive from.
I just noticed that Dave, KD0EAG, has joined us. Do you want to say something, Dave?
Not a lot of excitement here. I wasn't able to join right at the beginning. Just trying to catch what I can of the discussion. Mostly just listening today, I think. Take care.
Did you see Bill's progress on the N2 board on the Tangerine list?
Yes, I did. I did see that. And I don't know. I would like to test some of that code myself. I just haven't dug down and found where he's getting it from.
What code are you talking about?
Oh, the code you were using to benchmark the disk behavior.
Oh, okay. If you load the digital RF packet, and then you'll find a directory C, and underneath that examples, you have to have HDF5 installed, and then use H5CC to compile the benchmark. Along with RF write, both of those C modules together, and then you build the benchmark.
Okay, I was just gonna play with it myself because I have a variety of storage forms.
Yeah, that's good. It'd be interesting to see how, if you have a big solid state hard drive, it'd be interesting to see how an Odroid N2 will drive one of those. As I was, I don't know if you were in here, I was talking earlier, I discovered that the Odroid X4, you'll overload the CPU first, but the Odroid N2, the CPU is so much more powerful that you bump up against limits of the drives before you run into problems with the CPU.
That's really interesting. That is the kind of stuff you need to know.
So I have been looking at the Western Digital, or I guess it's Purple Video qualified hard drives, and they give a lifetime rating in terms of terabytes per year, and with the duty cycle that we're planning on with this application, it looks like we're going to hit the duty cycle within about 6 months, even on these video qualified hard drives. We're going to hit the lifetime anticipated amount of writes per year. Well, the amount of writes per we're going to hit that there it's allocated for, we're going to hit it in 6 months. So anyway, I mean, it doesn't mean we couldn't use them. It just means that even those good drives not necessarily have a totally lengthy lifetime like we would like.
That's really interesting. It's hard to get good measures of exactly what this kind of behavior is without just testing it, I guess.
So here's another user market for the board, is hard drive, solid state drive life testing.
Well, yeah, solid state drives don't have an infinite lifetime either. They're set up for a certain amount of read-write cycles, and eventually they actually wear out.
So what's the wear mechanism? The drives you were talking about are write cycles on a rotating platter, right? Like just a standard disk drive?
Yeah, those do wear. There's wear and tear on them. I can't go into any more detail on that because I don't really know what causes them to fail, but eventually they do. And solid state drives, they do have a wear and tear on them. You're putting a certain amount of wear and tear on different parts of the chips when you write to them, so they do eventually fail.
Is the goal the duty cycle that we're looking at, is that too ambitious, do you suppose?
Well, I don't know. In the past, we've generally anticipated we're going to be monitoring. We got a ring buffer. We're going to be monitoring two antennas at 192 kilosamples per second, eight channels. We're something like on the order of 4 terabytes a day or something, if I remember correctly. And so that when I look at these video qualified drives, which Tom was talking about, and then they probably are much better than your typical consumer or prosumer drives. They're designed to anticipate 180 terabytes per year write, and we'll hit that quite a bit sooner than after a year, writing 4 terabytes a day. Now, whether we might be able to get by with less. I mean, that's really kind of, I'm not an expert on the science enough to know how much data we need to collect to be able to do the science we want to do. I mean, it starts coming back to that. It starts coming back to requirements.
Yeah, we have a couple of options there. We scale maximum. The other possibility is that we take the 24-bit 2's complement samples and stream. We cut number of bytes that the disk by, or a third, so like 3 bytes instead of 4. So that gives us.
Well, and then if you do RAID 0 striping on drives, each for each drive you add, you cut it down by the factor of n, right?
Yeah, but then we might be up to needing 4 drives and pretty soon lost.
Yeah, but terabyte drives now are in the $30 range, rotating.
Yeah, I don't know what the cost of the purple ones are, and we shouldn't look just at the purple. The Seagate ones, they have a name for it as well. They have a similar stream.
It would be interesting to vastly exceed the write capability of one of these drives and see what happens, see what it does.
Maybe we could offer a program to the drive manufacturers that in exchange for a supply of a long-term life test for.
Yeah, all we have to do is keep track of the writes. And, you know, we already got serial numbers for packets. It seemed like it'd be too hard to add some metadata or something, keep track of the drive lifetimes.
Yeah, I'm looking at 4 terabyte Western Digital Purple. The 4 terabyte drive is $106 from Newegg.
And that's the purple? Is that so? How does that compare to like the green, which is the standard drive?
I don't have that in front of me. I can look into that and determine.
Yeah, I'm just trying to determine whether I would think that the purple ones would be more expensive than the standard one.
Well, let's see. The red one is $114. How does it compare? I don't know. For the same terabytes. I don't know what's the difference between the red and the purple.
Yeah, one key, usually the red ones are a design network attached storage, and so the error mechanism is different. Most disks in error reading a sec, pull the data off the sec, NAS, you'll have what's called time-limited error recovery. We'll try maybe 10 names and say, I still need the sec, so mechanism instead. So the reds are usually design aids. Where.
So then, what would the purples be designed for as opposed to the green one? Just more write longevity because you're usually doing lots and lots and lots of writes in the purple ones.
Yeah, exactly. They're designed to be put in a video surveillance box, be written to 24/7. Somebody look at something.
Yeah, I'm looking at Newegg. I'm not seeing red, purple, and black, and blue. Black and blue.
Okay, the blue one would be the standard then, and the black is the high performance.
That sounds about right.
I think the black one, the way they get their performance is they just run the revs up. And because if you go to the blue one or the standard one and try to find out what RPM it runs at, you can't because it varies depending on the load.
Oh, they spin them up and down?
Yeah. So I'm looking at the blue drive and saying, well, is it the 5400 RPM or is it the 7200 RPM? And the answer is yes. It depends on how much you access and how, you know, what your demands are. So it will actually, within limits, I guess, it'll change the spindle speed.
Okay. I didn't know that. Today's not wasted if you learn something.
Yeah, I know, because I tried to figure this out once, and it was frustrating, because nowhere do they give you that spec.
Okay, I see one that's marked with green now, and it's cheaper. It comes in what they call a bare drive. It looks like, it doesn't even look like it's got a case on it. It looks just the disk just spinning out there in free space.
I thought the green ones were some kind of power conservation power down, automatic power down modes, but I'm not sure what the blue ones would be then, except maybe the blue ones are standard, non-eco-friendly.
I wouldn't be surprised. You probably have it exactly. Anyway, we can't really figure this out now, but we have to keep this in our mind when we're designing this thing so that we come up with something that we can actually implement and it doesn't go off the rails 6 months after start into it.
Yeah, I think that solid-state drives, by the time we get this thing out, are going to be, it's hard to predict, but I've been watching the delta between the same size SSD versus, say, rotating drive, and you can see rotating drives falling in price, but you can see SSDs falling faster. So it's the on-sale prices I've seen, they're roughly about between 2x and 3x for SSDs compared to rotating devices. So I think my opinion is that eventually we're going to see the LCD phenomenon where rotating devices are just going to go away and you won't have them anymore. And solid state ones will be all you can get.
This is Scotty and Bill. This is Nathaniel.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I've been listening to all of this hard drive discussion, and it sounds like it's getting complicated, and it's getting complicated and expensive. I think what's probably going to have to happen is we're probably going to have to scale back our expectation in terms of how much data we can really store in this thing at a time. And we may have to, as we try to come up with what data products we actually want the device to have, you know, we may just have to store those reduced data products to disk, and then just have the ability to do burst or like campaign mode of storing raw IQ data. So maybe for like a special event or, you know, like during a contest, then we ask them all to write the full IQ data to disk. So that way we're not using the hard disks or the to their lifetime maximum usage. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we're already going to have throttling for internet connection anyway, just to prevent the device from taking over your entire internet connection. So it would seem like, I don't know how hard it would be, but I'm thinking we're going to have some kind of throttling mechanism, maybe just in the number of threads that you can run per drive, depending on the kind of drive you have. So you could maybe have a maximum throughput if you have a purple drive, and if you have a standard drive, you'd have a lower number. And because the worst thing we can do is have the thing burn out hard drives every 3 months.
Yeah, I agree. It seems to me that just based on a gut feeling with current price point of consumer hardware, like a 1 terabyte SSD might be a reasonable target of what we should design the system for. That seems like it would be reasonable to me.
So Bill, do you have a feeling for the right limits on a terabyte SSD versus a terabyte rotating drive? Do you have any kind of feel for that?
Not right off the top of my head. I've got some buddies and probably tell us. I can find that out and report back to them.
Yeah, that would be interesting to try to make a determination on which kind of drive to target.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing is, you know, we've been targeting for 8 simultaneous channels, but if we're going to record, if we're going to do a lot with WWV, who can get WWV on 8 simultaneous different frequencies? I mean, so it may be we have to tailor this a little bit closer to the actual science that Nathaniel and the science colleagues want to do.
Yeah, I think that might be true. And even with like looking at WWV or CHU, you know, you don't need 48 or 192 kilohertz of observations there. You know, you can probably do WWV with, say, 10 or 20 kilohertz. I'm not sure what the exact bandwidth is, but you could probably make it much more narrow.
Yeah, and you can not bother to listen on 2.5 megahertz on the East Coast during the day.
Yes, but the days that you do hear it, that would be the most interesting cases, right?
Yeah, you do have a point. You're looking for the anomalous cases, right?
On the other hand, if you know that you're looking for the anomalous cases and you don't hear anything, you don't record it, then you just record it when you hear it.
Yeah, so could that be another thing that you would do, is you could record the 192 kilohertz and you could, I mean, do a basic pre-processing on it to say, hey, look, all I heard was noise. There's nothing of interest here. Throw that one away. And when I see something that is something interesting, then I could save that.
Yeah, I think that's the idea behind the ring buffer, really, is you keep everything, the most recent stuff in the ring buffer in memory. And then if you look through that and you determine there is something interesting, then you write it to disk. So yeah, that's the basic idea.
Yeah, I'm just thinking of a very simple, dumb test to say, okay, I have a noise threshold that I know the radio's at. And, you know, if you're listening on 28 megahertz during the nighttime, and all you hear is everything below X sample from the ADC, you can say, well, there's really nothing that anybody's going to analyze here. Of course, maybe that's too simplistic, because I guess with integration, you can get signals below the noise, you can identify them, right? So maybe just a strict threshold isn't sufficient.
Yeah, no, that's true. A strict threshold isn't sufficient. I think, you know, my thought was you really try and design a general purpose receiver that you could then you could reprogram to do many of these different sorts of analysis or campaigns. But of course that's getting very broad again. But I think we certainly can scale back the requirement of, you know, a 4 terabyte something or other. I think we can do some very interesting things with a terabyte or 512 gigabytes, you know, if that's what we have to work with.
And that's also adding or different storage in the future, a fairly simple to solve, not requiring new hardware, but just disk drive existing to make new science possible approach.
Yeah, so Bill, when you say that you can take multiple drives and store multiple threads on different drives at the same time, I presume you're plugging each drive into a separate USB port. So the interface is not the restriction, it's the hard drive speed itself.
Yeah, that is what I so far.
Because I'm thinking that if you've got a disk drive that runs at, say, 150 megabytes per second, that's roughly about 1/3 of USB 2 high speed. So that would mean you could plug maybe 2 drives on or maybe 3 drives, but all those ports on that M2, my guess is going to be going through one hub and one port on the processor.
That seems quite likely, yeah.
So you're going to be limited to 480 megabits per second, right, on the USB 2, which is going to be about, that's even worse than I thought. So is it 480 megabits per second? So it's really about 60 megabytes per second is what you get on USB 2?
Well, I don't know. The Odroid N2 and all 4 of its ports are USB 3.
Okay, so go ahead, Dave.
I believe the N2, it's really one USB 3, I don't know what they call it, hub, with 4 ports attached to it. And as far as USB 2, the highest speed, effectively, it is about 30 megabits per second. And the usually USB 3 is quoted at about 10 times USB 2.
So USB 2 is 30 megabytes per second.
I think that's right. I could be wrong. But it's, you know, it's 480 divided by 8 bits divided with overhead and whatever else. I'm not sure what all else. But it seems to me a good USB 2 was 30-35 megabytes per second.
Okay, and USB 3 or 3.0 or 3.1, this seems to me, if I remember right, it's 5 megabits per second. That's megabits per second. So it's roughly 10 times what USB 2 high speed is. The super speed is roughly 10 times. But then they have USB 3.1, which goes up to 10 megabits per second.
The N2 doesn't support 3.1.
Okay, so your aggregate speed on all the USB ports is probably limited to 5 gigabits per second.
That would be my guess at best.
Which is about 500 megabytes per second. I just divide by 10 to account for some overhead. So maybe 500 megabytes are a little slower. But given the rotating drives, I think you'd be lucky to get above 100 megabytes per second on writes. You know, you could. That means you could basically fill up all 4 ports and not be limited by the interface.
Some of it's going to come down to the buffering and the on the drive and perhaps in the USB hub also.
Yeah, there is some buffering. You get various different data rates when you run the digital RF benchmarks, which tells me it kind of depends on how much is in the buffers and when you happen to hit them and things like that. There's going to be a buffer in the computer and a buffer in the drive as well.
Well, I'm certainly looking forward to burning out some disk drives testing.
Yeah, I'm planning to do that this week. I'm going to jump right on that.
You want me to send you some drives to test?
I've got several. I just bought another one at Best Buy on the way home with the intention of burning it out.
Yeah, because I upgraded both of my laptops here with terabyte SSDs. And I paid about $220 for the first one. It was on Black Friday last in 2018. And by the time I got around to the second one, it had dropped like $70 on non-Black Friday to about $150.
Yeah, I mean, clearly the price of all this stuff is down, and this would be less of a problem in the future than it is now. I guess we just have to. We have to be cognizant of, no matter what we, there is a lifetime to this equipment, and the, you know, coming right out of the box with our specs, we're going to be pushing them out to even the limits of what commercial grade equipment is designed for if we stick to our original design. Although, you know, it comes back to what we really need to do the science that we need to do. And that's kind of a little bit not totally clear in my mind.
Yeah, but of course, it always also comes down to how far can we push the hardware. So I guess if we have the capability of throttling the writes to the drive, which sounds like we might have to have that, then, you know, we can come at it from both ends. You know, the scientific guys say save everything, and the hardware guys say, oh, you can only save a little teeny bit of it. So there's got to be some happy in the middle.
Isn't that the usual case?
Yeah, like the hardware guys that asked me for an LED that came on when the battery was dead.
Yeah.
And they were serious, too. I don't know where they thought they were going to get the power to light it from. You know, that wasn't their problem. That was the engineer's problem.
Everything is always somebody else has to do.
That's right.
And Scotty, I'm going to have to take off now. I'll put out some notes and I'll sketch.
Okay, yeah, I think we probably ought to terminate it here, getting long-winded, which is easy for me to do anyway. So yeah, I'll send that stuff out to you, Tom. And I just checked. I do have the drawings on ARCAD, so I'll paste them into a Word document, put them up on the list, and let everyone see them.
Excellent. Bill, thanks for all your testing.
Well, I'm learning a little bit more each day. I think it's necessary in order to have my head in the game when it comes to writing software for the actual equipment we're going to design here. It's been a long time since I've coded for these kind of devices, just refreshing my memory on a lot of things.
Well, this is really good background info that we're going to need. And in lieu of jumping right in and designing hardware that we don't know what what we wanted to do, this is really good. So yeah, it's thanks, Bill, for doing all that.
My pleasure. It takes me, it's kind of like deja vu all over again. It's like, man, the last time I worked on some of this stuff was this kind of stuff was coding and stuff like this is back in the mid 80s, but it's fun.
Well, now you're dating yourself.
Remember, I graduated from Tech in 73, yeah. So, and I've been writing. Even when I went to Virginia Tech in 69, I was always already a pretty good programmer from stuff we did in high school. So, yeah, I'm pushing. I'm right at 50 years doing this.
Yeah, I graduated from RPI in 75, so just 2 years behind you.
Well, Bill, practice makes.
Yeah, that's why doctors practice. Are we done here?
Yeah, I think so. Unless anyone has any final comments.
Just want to say thank you all, and try to catch from the beginning next week. 73 to y'all.
Yeah, thank you very much. And I will continue to work on getting the HAMSci workshop and that squared away as I go through my transition. And I think we'll also continue to talk about what actual science can do with the capabilities that we have. So that will hopefully narrow down the requirements a bit more.
Okay, well, thanks, Nathaniel, and everyone for signing on, and we'll be on the list all week and then back here next week.
Okay, by the way, you might have gotten an email. I added that Wayne Link stuff to DX display, so take a look at that and give me your feedback.
Okay, Bill. Yes, I saw that. Thank you very much. I will send some feedback on that.
All right, thanks.
Oh, and Tom, one other thing. I'll send you an email with my FTP server, and you can upload that file directly to it, if you're still there, Tom.
Sorry, wrong. I hit the Alt key. I'll upload it. I was only able to catch an occasional symbol, the loudest SSB.
Okay, I'll try listening to it and see what it comes across as. We can discuss where to go from there. Maybe a different band segment or different time or something.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I recorded when I thought 20 meters was going to be. I will re-encode it to 32-bit wave format instead of 6, and that'll make the file for 10 minutes about.
Okay, yeah, we have a huge drive on this, no problem.
Very good. I have an extra pipe to that, so I think a gigabyte's going to go at 100% efficiency.
Oh, wow, because we have a 25 megabit pipe up to us, so. It'll definitely be slow on your end.
Yeah, I'm in the hundreds. I'm just under a.
You want to mail me a thumb drive?
It might get there sooner.
Yeah, okay. Well, we'll try it this way. If it doesn't work, we can go with the sneaker net. So anyway, thanks a lot, everyone, in 7-3.